WHTH AM and FM Boston. WHTH Radio News and Public Affairs now presents the Harvard Law School Forum, recorded Friday night for rebroadcast at this time. Tonight's program features highlights of the discussion subject of Blueprint for Defense. And now our guest speaker, General Maxwell D. Taylor.
I'm very happy to be allowed to come to the forum this evening to talk about some of the aspects of our national defense problems. Frankly, I almost didn't make it. I was entrapped in Washington today on a long series of conferences, which all made me first to miss Dr. Kissinger's seminar this afternoon, and to whom I extend my apologies on this occasion. As a matter of fact, the conference which I was attending looked as if it were running well into the night. And I spoke up rather timidly from the rear row and said, I'm very sorry, I have a speaking engagement. I'm going to have to leave at 4 o'clock. Frowns on all sides. Growls from all sides. Then I said, but I'm speaking at Harvard. So smiles appeared. Here I am. What I thought I would like to chat with you about, because this is not a formal address, are some of the problems we're faced with in Washington in formulating a new blueprint for our defense. It has been a long time, I think, since we have really surveyed what we are doing, where we are going in national defense, and why some of the very expensive and long-range problems are really necessary. I was a heretic for almost 4 years as Chief of Staff of the Army, arguing for this need for reappraisal. And now I have that very unhappy feeling of becoming almost orthodox, because it seems to me the atmosphere in Washington is indeed recognition of the fact that there are new important factors in the international scene which require a very close restudy of what our objectives are and whether indeed our defense efforts are giving Clausewitzian sense to carrying forward, or the capability of carrying forward, our policies, our national objectives by other means, if those other means are indeed required. I encounter, as I go about the country, a great interest in national defense, far greater than I can remember in all of my active years of service, where the questions are being raised. Just how important was yesterday's headline? What indeed does it mean that we have a new missile-launching submarine, that we have a new division, that we have a new bomber, let's say? And the questioning, a very intelligent and worried questioning sometimes, as to how does this fit into our pattern? Why is it indeed necessary? What is the significance? We have columnists all about the country who render a service, to a certain point at least, in interpreting what the headlines mean. But I feel that, generally speaking, there is a great deal of confusion in the minds of our most sincere and serious citizens as to where, indeed, we are going in national defense. It is indeed encouragement, as I said at the outset, to find that now in Washington, there is indeed the desire, the intention, to first look at our policies, our strategy, our objectives, to relate those military objectives to political objectives, and then decide whether indeed we are headed in the right direction. I have suggested in writing and orally, if anyone will listen to me, that the first requirement is to review the record and see what has happened to our national defense since World War II, and indeed what concept of military strategy has been behind our budgets, our decisions in the political field, sometimes in our ideological field, and which have been the guiding factors up to the present moment. I think it's fair to say, although it's oversimplification to a degree, that from World War II up until this year, I would say, we have been following a military strategy based upon massive retaliation. That is to say, the use or the threat of the use of weapons of great destructiveness, in the hope that our possession of these weapons would indeed keep the peace, more or less, on American terms. I can recall that feeling after the two explosions in Japan, that indeed the United States was the possessor, and it seemed then the sole possessor, of a weapon that was almost absolute in its qualities for maintaining the peace in a sort of Pax Americana. In that spirit, we disbanded our conventional forces, as we now call them, after World War II, the great divisions that had won the war in the Far East and in Europe, sent them home in that mad rush which broke up the greatest military machine that any Anglo-Saxon power had ever had. Then came the years where we felt secure and were not challenged in the fact that we were the sole possessor of the atomic weapon. And that should have continued indefinitely in the minds of the theorists, the believers in massive retaliation, had Korea not occurred. And there was a great shock, to those gentlemen in high position in the military circles who believed, indeed, that massive retaliation was the final answer in national defense. And what did we have in Korea? A so-called conventional war where we deliberately abstained from using atomic weapons, even though we were the sole possessor of these weapons at the time. Were we right? I don't know. That is hotly argued and probably be debated through the halls of history for many decades to come. But nonetheless, the responsible leaders of our nation in the Korean War decided that it was against our interest to use these weapons for reasons which seemed sufficient to them at the time. And Korea ended up a slugging, hard fight for hilltop after hilltop, fought by infantrymen with rifles and machine guns in their hands, even though we had the greatest Air Force and the greatest Navy and the atomic bomb in our arsenal at the time. Korea should, I think, have shaken our confidence in massive retaliation as the keystone to our military strategy, but strangely enough, it did not. There were many reasons, many explanations why Korea was the exception. The rule would be general atomic war if war occurred. And as a result, as a nation, we continued to spend our money. Our blue chips went on those weapons and those services which represented the capability for massive retaliation. During my 4 years as chief of staff, in spite of long and hard debates and acrimonious argumentation within the halls of the Pentagon, in the White House, and in Congress, we continued to spend our money within 0.5%, 48% to the Air Force, 28% to the Navy, and 23% to the Army. Now, whether those percentages are right, I am on a given year, I wouldn't presume to say. I didn't think so. But I do know it's concrete evidence of the frozen thinking in national defense for those critical years, the fact we never recognized the world was changing and our problem was changing. The payoff, ladies and gentlemen, in Washington are not the speeches you hear in Congress, not the speeches you hear on the campaign platform, but the fine print of the federal budget. Where your treasure goes, there is indeed your heart. Now, with that background, we come more or less to the present, the situation which the new administration has inherited in Washington. And what do we find has occurred during these years where we have continued more or less rigidly to pursue a strategy of massive retaliation? In this period, we have lost our technological lead over the Soviets, our major enemy, in a number of important categories. Certainly in the long-range missile field, we are lagging largely because of our failure to emphasize the development of powerful rocket engines. We are now beginning to fear that we have depended too long on manned aircraft, the manned bomber, which has been and is today our major weapon for delivering atomic weapons in strategic attack. We are now talking about a missile gap and wondering just what the missile gap means. If I may interject here, what I think the missile gap truly means. Sometimes it's interpreted to mean the question, do we have as many big missiles as the Soviets? And I think that's a very hard question to answer. I recall that Secretary McElroy a couple of years ago said he thought they did have more missiles than we or soon would have. I don't think that in itself is too important. In this business where a missile carries in its warhead the life of a city, it's not too important how many of these terrible weapons any nation possesses. So that the so-called numbers racket is only one aspect of this, of the missile gap, if indeed a missile gap exists. I would say that instead of talking about a missile gap, we should probably talk about missile effectiveness, meaning our ability to use a missile weapon system in retaliation in case of general atomic war. And that would include three or perhaps four factors. First, how many do we have? Second, how reliable are our missiles? Second, how vulnerable are our own missiles to attack, assuming, as we always do, that we will never launch this kind of attack deliberately ourselves? And finally, our knowledge of the other man's target. What are we going to shoot at? Now, it's that combination of four factors in proper balance which represents true missile effectiveness. So that instead of talking about a missile gap, I think we should talk in terms of missile effectiveness. Now, having raised the question, you will may be inclined to ask, well, what do you think about how do we stand in missile effectiveness? Well, I would tick off those four points about this way. Numbers, I suspect the Soviets have more operational missiles than we do simply because they put the emphasis on missiles first. We hung on to the manned bomber much longer than the Soviets. Second, reliability. I don't know. I don't think anybody in our country knows, has data which indicates whether our missiles are better than the Soviets. So I would just put a question mark. But when I get down to the other two points, vulnerability. Do they know where our missiles are? Do we put it in the newspaper? Are the coordinates of every missile site we have recorded in Moscow? Obviously. Furthermore, our missiles are on pads that don't move. They're not sunk in the ground. They have no mobility. They have no concealment. So we're very critical vulnerability, then, is on the minus side as we view the problem. Then the other aspect of vulnerability is how vulnerable is the other fellow? Do we know where he is? We do not. He doesn't publish his coordinates in the newspaper. So in those last two points, I would say, indeed, we are critically at a disadvantage. And hence, on balance, I would say there is indeed a missile gap or a gap in missile effectiveness. So I would say that new factor has come into the picture, which indeed raises the question of whether or not we shouldn't have a new blueprint of national defense and a reappraisal of our strategy. But that is, of course, only one side of the picture. That's the general war, the great atomic war menace. Meanwhile, we're seeing more and more that perhaps indeed that is not where our major potential loss may be found. Isn't it in the field of limited war, limited challenge, infiltration, the kind of thing we're seeing in the Congo, the kind of thing that is developing in Laos, the kind of thing which is on our doorstep in Cuba? Isn't that indeed the kind of military threat which may indeed be most dangerous to us? I lump that over into the general category of readiness for limited or cold war. And I would say that our great defect in the last decade has been to ignore that side of the problem. And only today are we seeing the tremendous amount of back work which is before the present administration in remedying that serious defect. Now, these flaws in our strategy and our preparations are being perceived, of course, by our allies. NATO, particularly, which we have described as the keystone to our defense policy, those nations have perceived the dangers of reliance on weapons of massive retaliation. No European shows any enthusiasm for atomic warfare. On the other hand, he is deeply afraid of the challenge which might be presented in case the Russians or their satellites move westward in some aggressive move using conventional weapons and announcing in advance that that atomic weapons will never be used. That kind of thing impressed the late Secretary of State Dulles so greatly that he came to the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1958. And said, unless we find a better national strategy than massive retaliation, to which I gave my name, he was a great man, big enough to recognize that he was taking great responsibility. unless we find a strategy more appealing to our NATO allies than massive retaliation, NATO will not last another 2 years. That, of course, was an invitation to us in the Pentagon and in the executive branch of the government to start the kind of reappraisal of our strategy which is being done today. Unfortunately, that day was delayed almost 3 years. So now we are faced indeed with the problem of overhauling our defenses, looking at our assets and our liabilities, and adjusting ourselves to a new situation which recognizes the factors which I have described. What obstacles will the new administration find in making this new blueprint for our national defense? Well, there'll be a number of them, all serious, but all of which can be overcome. The Pentagon, Washington, the federal government, is a very ponderous thing. It wheels within wheels, so that the very effort of adjusting the great bureaucracy to the requirement of a thorough restudy of our military situation will not be easy. And very fine men as we have now in the new administration, I'm sure their patience and their ability will be taxed by this requirement. I think they will find very shortly that the National Security Council, which was set up primarily to be a forum of advice to the president on matters of national defense, has become too big, too cumbersome to be an effective forum in which to discuss seriously these matters of national defense. I note, based upon newspaper reports, that President Kennedy is using the NSC less than President Eisenhower and depending more and more on direct consultation of a small group of his senior advisors. Whether that's good or bad, I'm not quite sure yet, but at least it shows a recognition that the old system was not ideal. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, of which I was a member, and all the present members are close friends of mine, I feel that institutionally has failed to be the source of military advice of the best quality to assist the President and the Secretary of Defense in discharging their very heavy obligation. I think the faults of the Joint Chiefs of Staff are not personal faults, but rather institutional faults, in the sense that the Joint Chiefs are a committee, and a committee can do some things, but there are many, many things a committee cannot do. Those things which are advisory in nature, where the time factor are not important, are well within the scope of a committee such as the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But when the question of decisions, rapid decisions on operational matters, such as could have occurred in Cuba in the last 2 or 3 days, no committee is able to run a war. And that, I think, is one of the charge against the Joint Chiefs, which cannot be laid to one side. Also, the new administration will find that the kind of reappraisal we're talking about is hard from a budgetary point of view. Budgets are very dry subjects, and I'm not going to discuss the federal defense budget tonight to this group. But the federal defense budget should be more than a columns of figures which add up and balance to the right and on the left. It should be a translation into financial terms of the strategy of the United States. In other words, it's giving the financial support to those decisions which have been taken with regard to where we're going in national defense. Unfortunately, the very format of the way we keep our budget in Washington, adding up the expenses of the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines, is absolutely meaningless. You, as taxpayers and serious citizens, couldn't possibly decide what kind of military operations the United States could conduct by looking at that budget. I can assure you, neither can the President of the United States, neither can the Secretary of Defense, neither can the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Until we change our budgeting so we spend our dollars knowingly on certain types of operational forces, we will never know how we stand in our security. But that is somewhat of a technical question, and I will pursue it no further other than to say it's going to be a serious obstacle to the Kennedy administration in doing the very fine things they intend to do in reappraising our strategy. It may be that the new administration is creating difficulties for itself in these very large numbers of task forces made up largely of civilians who have just come to Washington in dealing with these defense questions. I'm sorry I'm old-fashioned in the matters of national defense. I feel that in this field, as in any other field, from making of shoes to laying railroad ties to being lawyers, to being doctors, any other career, knowledge of the business should be no handicap. Unfortunately, in Washington, very frequently, the fact that one has military experience is a reason for throwing him out of the council room. Well, now, those are obstacles I mentioned in passing because I know they're there, but I mention them with optimism because I also think this group of people who are now in Washington have great enthusiasm, great drive, great determination. And I think in due time they will overcome most of them. What kind of blueprint do I think they should come up with? I hate to say because I have only I'm one man's opinion, but it seems to me there will be little disagreement in certain categories of decision. It seems to me that inevitably the new blueprint which is being worked upon will emphasize, as in the past, the need for a strong atomic strategic deterrent force that obviously able to destroy the Soviet Union if the Soviet Union attacks the United States with these great weapons. At the present time, we have such a force, but that force is dwindling in effectiveness because of the dwindling effectiveness of the manned bomber. Only by a very heavy effort in the missile field can we have reliable missiles, not missiles, but reliable missiles, in a reasonably short period of time to give us this protection. We must, however, recognize that these new missiles must in turn have protection against surprise attack. Hence, the defensive side is almost, if not equally as important, as the offensive side. There's been a shibboleth in Washington for the last 8 years that the offense is the best defense. Well, that has a good, bold, ringing sound, but it just isn't so. The Harvard football team will never go out here with nothing but a backfield and no line. If so, they're not going to do too well. No more will any military force. Yet we have deliberately ignored the defensive requirements of our missile force. We have not been willing to take the plunge and go for the Nike Zeus anti-missile, which is just as important as the striking force of the Atlas and the Polaris system. On the defensive side, we've been strangely timid. We've been very bold indeed on the offensive side. The result is an imbalance, which must be corrected, and I think should be included in the new blueprint. In other words, when you get all through, you have what in the jargon of the Pentagon is, you have a second strike missile force. That means you can take the first strike, absorb it, and still strike back with overwhelming effect. But just as important as this kind of glamorous force, the kind of thing that causes the headline, the kind of strength we need for limited war, for the Korean type of war, for what goes on in Cuba, the Congo, what might happen in Laos, well, it might happen in many parts of the world. A capability, a military strength, which we have deliberately neglected. No one has ever argued against the necessity. We've simply said in the past, we can't afford it. The other thing will really, if we have the great atomic strength, that will accommodate us to all situations. That, indeed, is the great fallacy of our past strategy. The belief that these great weapons of unlimited destructiveness give us a protection against all kinds of military threat. That concept must go. I think it has gone. The real question is how to implement in a short period of time the required revitalization of our limited war and our Cold War forces. The new blueprint will also take into consideration the need of strengthening our alliances. We have alliances all over the world. We have commitments to between 40 and 48 nations that under various conditions we will give the military aid. But those alliances in the course of recent years are falling apart. The mortar is falling away. The confidence in the United States and the leader has fallen away largely because of our fallacious strategy depending again on the big atomic weapon. Only by assuring NATO and other less important of our alliances that we can indeed assist them in time and with weapons which do not assure the destruction of those being saved will give us the new strength, the new cohesiveness which is falling out of our alliance system. Finally, this new blueprint must assure to our government and all of us who contribute to the support of our government, that we're using our financial resources to the best effect, that we're not wasting our means, that indeed we're putting our money on the blue chips in a proper priority of requirements. Now, let me just mention make a few comments on those 4 points. The invulnerable missile force, limited war and Cold War forces, effective alliances, and the use of our resources. The missile force I'm talking about is not going to be a big one. Again, we have been confused by numbers. Why do we have to have thousands of bombers, thousands of missiles, each one carrying megaton warhead, when 200 or 300 will destroy any nation? The real question should be, I think, how many of these weapons on target represents the destruction which we feel is necessary, or the threat of destruction which will prevent this kind of warfare ever occurring. In limited war forces, how much do we need? Well, we should study what might occur in Laos and ask ourselves how many divisions, how many battalions, how many aircraft are necessary for those situations. But in all cases, we should be thinking how to use our resources intelligently on some at least quasi-scientific basis, and not simply piling expenditure on expenditure just to get a headline, just to get a service dollar, without accounting for the effect upon our overall military strategy. In the case of our alliances, particularly in NATO, we're at a very critical point now with regard to giving NATO atomic weapons. How to meet that very natural fear of our European friends that if the cards are down in this period of mutual deterrence, where we in the Soviet Union have essentially equal ability to destroy one another, that when the cards are down, we will not use our weapons. That fear is in the heart of every European statesman. And that results in the request from NATO for us to give atomic weapons, to give either on a national basis or on a NATO basis. In my judgment, the latter is the obvious solution. That General Norstat, the Supreme Commander of Europe, should have atomic weapons given to him, which he will dispose of in throughout his military command, which is the European NATO command, available for use by NATO, not by any single power. This, I think, will meet the requirements of everyone except our friend Charles de Gaulle. Whether or not he will be content, I am not at all certain. Now, when this is all through, then, I would say that we should, after having given a rational basis for our military requirements, answering the question, how much is enough in every category, then I think that the Department of Defense is ready to come with this blueprint to the President, to the National Security Council, and say this is the reason why we think we need certain categories of forces, not armies, navies, air forces, but categories of forces in terms of the atomic deterrent force, limited war forces, continental air defense, operational type forces. Then having made sense in the presentation of the requirement, then say, now look, we can't plan any longer on an annual budget. We need a longer survey in point of time of how the money allocated to national defense will come to us, so that we can plan a program and know it will be completed 5 years hence without any question of whether or not it will be supported. That to me means the concession on the part of the executive branch of the government of a sort of commitment of some percentage of the gross national product for national defense. I have used in some of my writing 10%, because it seems to me to be quite a modest increase over what we're doing, yet consistent with our growing requirements. But I'm quite sure that a blueprint of national defense should carry with it a commitment of some reasonable percentage for planning purposes, so that the Department of Defense doesn't live from day to day or from year to year in these programs which are so very long. Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, is about what I wanted to lay before you as the basis for discussion before this very able panel, and to your questions that you're going to ask, I hope, in the subsequent period. It seems to me that the kind of outline I've given you of a so-called blueprint of national defense, if carried out, would eventually produce forces appropriate to our needs and capable of supporting the attainment of the national objectives, which depend upon our military strength. Such forces would not rely on any one weapon system as we have relied in the past, but would permit a strategy of flexible response, offering many alternatives to our leaders when they're faced with these varying crises which are coming up as the years go by. Once in being, these forces would go far to assure that respect for the power of the United States, which is an indispensable factor for the long-term maintenance of the peace. Thank you very much. I look forward to our question period.
Proceed. Are asked to come to the front so they may speak into this loudspeaker. And in order that we might not lose unnecessary time, it is desired that at least one additional person might be on hand so that the questioning and answering can proceed apace. May I ask for the first question? Would you step up to this?
General Taylor, I think perhaps one of the major problems in our defense policy may have been pointed up this evening by not what you said, but what you didn't say. And in this, I was referring to any comments about Polaris and this as a deterrent. And I thought possibly this might point up a competition between the armed forces. And if this did, or whether it did not, what can we do about getting the forces, or the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, to work together when they have had all their training and all their work as separate bodies?
That, of course, is a very pertinent question. And no one can deny, certainly I would not, that service rivalry has been a serious factor in making more difficult the decisions of our civilian leadership in Washington. On the other hand, I always defend myself and my colleagues in this sense, that our very system of setting up our budgets calls for, metaphorically speaking, putting a sack of $40 billion in front of four very determined men, all sure that their service really represents the security of the United States, and then being surprised that an argument ensues. I think it would ensue if any of you, ladies and gentlemen, were in a similar position. The only answer I have to your question is not that there can be any suppression of this service competition when sincere men feel they have a case, but a resolute civilian at the head of the Secretary of the Department of Defense and the Commander-in-Chief who will decide these things in time.
Next question, please.
General Taylor, your emphasis and that of others on an increased capacity for conventional warfare as opposed to strategic atomic warfare infers that it is to be hoped from this that we will be more likely, be better able to stem the advance of communism by participation in more limited conventional engagements such as we did in Korea. I'm not convinced, however, that had we had this capacity even 8 years ago, that we would have become directly involved so far in crises such as Laos, the Congo, and Cuba, which you mentioned. I wonder if we are not at a point now where the emphasis on limited conventional warfare in a formal manner is as outdated as massive retaliation was some years back. It seems to me that politically we are either unwilling or unable now to engage in most areas of the world, even in that sort of combat. And I wonder if the actual step to make is not to a further doctrine which would help us to aid local forces in such activities as subversion, infiltration, and development of their own capacities.
Well, let me make it very clear that in arguing for the need of a limited war capability, I'm not arguing in favor of limited wars.
Any more than insisting on the need for general atomic capability, I'm arguing in favor of having an atomic war. We military people have a very limited role to play, and properly so. Namely, that we provide an instrument or a series of instruments for our civilian leadership, our political leadership, to use as they see fit when the occasions arise. Where we have failed in the past is have only that big indiscriminate stick or club of massive retaliation. And I'm simply saying we owe it to our leadership to give them other choices. And that is what my argument means in favor of a limited war. I would then, picking up your thought of the Cold War requirements, they're highly important. We have neglected them. In the past, in my own thinking, I rather lumped them with limited war. But more and more I see clearly there is indeed a third category, the kind of unconventional warfare in which we're unskilled, yet strangely enough, we at one time were the experts of the world when we fought against the Indians in the West. So there is indeed this new horizon of military requirements in this unconventional field, which I think will grow in importance as time goes on.
Yes?
General Taylor, I have a sort of double question about one part of our capabilities, that of the Navy. Can we assume initially that Russia now has conventional submarines which are equipped with surface-to-surface hydrogen missiles which can be fired from underwater for at least 300 miles? I don't know. I see.
But I'm sure they will have a Polaris type weapon sooner or later. In the very tough competition in which we exist today, neither side is going to stay ahead with a unique weapon system very long.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, if we make then three assumptions to start with, what I've understood is more or less from the Navy grapevine is that our supercarriers, whenever they are at sea, report they are continually tracked by at least one submarine, presumably Russian. My question is, if we assume, one, that Russia soon will have the submarines you described, Polaris type, two, that our carriers are continually tracked, three, that the Russian Navy will find out as soon as the U.S. Navy, if total war breaks out, what happens to our carriers? Are they useless sitting ducks?
First, I don't trust Navy scuttlebutt. secondly, you ought to ask Admiral Burke that last question, because I personally feel that the carrier, like the man bomber, has limited future utility. However, I could be biased.
Thank you.
In the discussions by the four eminent speakers, all on the question of defense, there was nothing mentioned of what might be called hardening of the population to make them less vulnerable and less a highly desirable target than with regard to the missiles. Since I won't direct the question specifically to anyone, since I think all of you skipped around it, none of you really dealt with it, why isn't, to me, the urgent question of civil defense, fallout shelters, etc., under the general heading of defense, when this to me seems to be almost one of the most critical problems?
Perhaps, Professor Kissinger, would you like to address yourself to that question?
I was hoping I wouldn't be asked. all right. Well, I think one reason civil defense isn't part of the military program has something to do with the condition that General Taylor described, that a fixed budget is put before the Joint Chiefs, and there has been a very great reluctance on the part of the Defense Department to take on any new mission for fear that the funds for that mission would have to come out of some existing capability. The Defense Department has been most reluctant to take on the task of civil defense. Partly for this reason. Secondly, there has been a great political reluctance to tell the people some of the facts of life in the nuclear age. It has been considered politically very difficult to have a major civil defense program. These would be the reasons why this, in my judgment, why it hasn't been done. I myself believe that at least a certain amount of information about how to behave in such situations is required, if only from the point of view of public morality. I don't see how one can keep one's population exposed as it is now without giving them a minimum of knowledge of how to behave, if only in case of accident.
May I just ask the questioner a question which sounds frivolous, and I don't want to be frivolous or facetious to a very serious question, but suppose the United States government did dig a hole in the ground for this gentleman to live in, would he get in it?
Would you kindly respond to that?
Could I make a comment on this same thing before we leave it?
Yes. Would you like first to have this question answered? And
oh, yes, fine.
Sir?
Unfortunately, I don't have a house, and so I can't build a fallout shelter, and it's a little bit difficult in an apartment. The answer is, if I had a house, yes, I would. I would consider this an expenditure of roughly comparable to all other forms of life insurance and general insurance, since I honestly consider the probability of my dying that way about equal to any other way, and the answer is, yes, I would.
I hope you all bear in mind we're talking about the missile age where, since the warning is 15 minutes, it'll be a permanent residence.
I just wanted to make a further comment along that same line. I served for a time as the chief radiation officer for a part of Manhattan. It is my conviction that there is no program for civil defense which has been evolved up to this point which makes any sense, which is one reason why we don't have one. In effect, the kind of programs that have been envisaged, which would be enormously expensive and would change our way of life in the sense that General Taylor was talking about, of our living underground, seem to me to have the capability, perhaps, in an all-out nuclear war, and that's what we're talking about if we want to have bomb shelters, the capability, perhaps, for reducing the initial casualties from 75 million to 50 million the first day. And I don't think that's a tremendously big difference quantitatively or qualitatively. I want to avoid the 50 million instead of cutting it down from 75 to 50.
It's a nice hope.
Dr. Ranson, I'd like to ask you a question about a point that General Taylor brought up. He called for the extension of funds appropriated for military purposes. Now, do you think that this will be at all possible in the near future in light of Congress's unwillingness to give up its power of review every year and also of the constitutional prohibition against long-term military appropriations?
I think it's going to be very difficult to persuade Congress to exercise the self-restraint that I called upon them a few minutes ago from that platform to do. I doubt that they were listening to me. It's going to be very difficult. On the constitutional issue, I think that that in effect this is not a serious problem. The Constitution says that the appropriations are limited to 2 years, but obligations can be made by Congress in effect, to get around that. I think the essential problem is a congressional unwillingness to recognize the need for long-range planning, because that would remove from their hands some of the real decision-making authority, the real decision-making power. Unless we have this kind of self-restraint, though, I think we're going to be in trouble.
What does the panel think about the counterforce finite deterrence controversy?
Counterforce. counterforce finite.
The questioner has addressed himself to the panel, so the panel has to confer.
I had forgotten my Pentagonese. I had to have that interpreted. Does the audience understand the question?
Well, as I understand it, the Air Force wants a missile force which will be aimed at destroying the enemy's forces, whereas the Army and the Navy want a missile force which will be aimed at destroying the enemy's population centers as well as the enemy's missile forces.
Yes, you're quite right. That's an accurate statement. I just wondered, I'm being facetious, I wondered if everyone understood the terminology involved. I, of course, you know what coat I wore, and was not. I didn't arrive at this thinking, however, by the color of my coat. I would share the view of any military man that we would like to destroy military targets, if possible. No one I've ever heard who looks forward with the anticipation of destroying cities as a military objective. But I've always said there's really no argument involved in this in the period we're coming into, because one. If we mean we're not going to strike first, then the enemy's missiles are off the pad. They're gone. They're not to be struck. There's no target there. Two, even if we intended to strike first, we don't know where their missiles are. Hence, there's no target system. So to me, it's an academic question of no real, and there's no real substance in it. Again, I could be biased.
I wonder if any of the other members of the panel would comment on that.
I would agree with General Taylor on that question. I would add a third consideration, that on any interpretation of the missile guard, it is going to be for the foreseeable future technically impossible to wipe out the Soviet retaliatory force, because airplanes take too long to get to missile sites, and on any definition of even equality in numbers of long-range missiles, we're not going to be able to do it technically. So I would agree it's largely an academic question for the next 4 to 5 years.
Next question.
My question is directed to General Taylor. It is, how effective is our present reserve program? And by that I mean program which I will be embarking on in July, 6 months of active duty, followed by 5.5 years of one night a week meetings and 2 weeks in the summer. From a national defense standpoint, how effective is it?
Is this an offer of enlistment or a hypothetical question? I'm very glad to answer that question. I would say that of all the areas of our Army part of national defense, during my 4 years as Chief of Staff, I thought the progress made in the reserve program was the greatest, largely because of the fact, for the first time, we have insisted on sound basic training for the individuals going to the National Guard and into the reserve. Now, what does that mean? That means it's effective in relation to what the purpose of these units are. The purpose of the Guard and the reserve is in a conventional war rather than limited, rather than general war, to have backup forces ready to move out of the United States, trained for combat at a rate which will allow them to proceed without a break behind the regular forces. I would say we've never quite achieved that, but we were nearer achieving it 2 years ago than we ever had in our past history, and I'm sure progress has been made in the last 2 years. No one suggests that our reserve units should be. The objective is not to make them duplicates of the regular Army. If they got that good, there's something wrong with the regular Army, because you can't be a part-time soldier, presumably, and be as well as if you're a full-time soldier. But we do have logic in our reserve program today, and I would say that it's for the first time we're really getting return on our investment.
Next question.
This question is directed to General Taylor, and I hope Dr. Wolf would comment. With any sort of luck, an interested person can learn about conventional and nuclear warfare. Every now and then we hear something about chemical and bacteriological warfare, but we hardly know anything about it at all, and our scientists have been very reticent here themselves. I was wondering, sir, if you could comment perhaps on our defensive and offensive capabilities here. Do we have any sort of blueprint in these fields?
I had a rebuttal point against Dr. Wolf, which is to suggest. Dr. Wolf makes, with whom I am in complete agreement insofar as his point that there's no health, there's nothing wholesome in this kind of living where we exist only by a balance of terror. However, when one suggests that the settlement of the atomic arms issue settles everything, I can't join that. I don't think Dr. Wolf said that, but there's an implication among many of our speakers and writers on this subject that if we could settle the atomic arms weapon, that kind of destructive force, then we would have a reasonable chance of existing without the threat of mass destruction. Of course, your point is just to suggest the opposite. That suppose we did put aside these atomic weapons, I'm quite sure these very eminent scientists like Dr. Wolf would turn up with a better chemical weapon than the atomic weapons everywhere. As a matter of fact, there are, one sees very unpleasant possibilities in the whole chemical field, which would probably be pursued, except that now the atomic weapon system is so expensive, so destructive, it seems hard to justify finding another way to destroy mankind. But I'm quite certain that the atomic issue is only one aspect of how to adapt science to a world in which we can live peaceably and explore the universe without destroying the universe.
My comment would be that I can't disagree. I do not feel that the solution of some sort of mechanism for stopping nuclear warfare is in itself the end of our search. I believe that there is a pressing threat here in the sense that this is the existing mode by which we are now capable of making enormous destruction. And I have had hopes which are becoming dim in view of the attitude of Mr. Tsarapkin at Geneva, though I still haven't quite given up hope, that we might at least agree on this business of stopping the further development of nuclear weapons through an agreement to stop the testing of nuclear weapons. The principal virtue of this in my mind is that it involves the establishment of an inspection and control mechanism with which we could gain some experience about how we go about actually operating inspection and control systems that have to operate in our territory and in the territory of the Soviet Union. On the question of biological and chemical warfare, I can't claim any expert knowledge. I'm sure that there are real problems here that are difficult in establishing any kind of controls over these things, as there are in the nuclear field. And I certainly did not mean to imply at any point in my discussion, but I think the problems that have to be solved are easy ones, and neither do I believe that we can disarm unilaterally, as some people seem to think, because I think they haven't thought about the problem enough. I see a necessity for carrying on with the kind of defense program that General Taylor talked about, while at the same time recognizing that this is not a long-range solution of our problems, and working also on this other approach.
Thank you. Next question.
General Taylor commented that we wouldn't use first strike. We wouldn't take the first strike in nuclear war. And I'm very glad to hear this, because recently there are some theorists have stressed the need for what is called a first strike capability. Herman Kahn poses a rather elaborate series of hypothetical cases, and that I think, for instance, suppose the Russians decide to invade Western Europe, do we, with conventional weapons, do we then send in, do we then attack Russia with nuclear weapons? And he says that in order to make this, we've said we would in ways, we would go to war against Russia, we have treaty obligations. Now, he says that since that we must build a force and civil defense capability so that we could go to war without losing more than 20 million people in this situation. Now,
Could some of you comment on this theory? Oh, also that we'd go to war with a first strike. We could.
General Taylor, would you like
to... I haven't read the Khan's book. I'm sure you have, Dr.
Well, I think the second favorite indoor sport in Cambridge at the moment is attacking Herman Khan. On the basis of what Herman Khan was doing in a somewhat flamboyant fashion was to analyze how the theory of massive retaliation would work in the defense of peripheral areas. And his theory was that if we relied on our then prevalent strategy, the implication would have to be that an attack by the Soviets on Europe would have to be, we would have to reply with an all-out strike against the Soviet Union. And if we were committed to this kind of strategy, it implied all kinds of other consequences. Now, the chief criticism that I think, what I think Herman Khan did is to show us all what the implications of our strategy were. This happened to be the prevalent American strategy. The fact that Herman Khan faced it, and some of our policymakers did not face it, is no indictment of Herman Khan, it seems to me. At any rate, he wasn't advocating this. He was analyzing, as far as I could understand him, on this particular point, he was analyzing its implications. And if the doctrine of massive retaliation ever made any sense, it was precisely that an attack by the Soviet Union on an ally of ours would have as a response a first strike against the Soviet Union in that sense.
Which is the fallacy largely of the mass retaliation concept.
But this was the theory of it, that we would make an all-out strike against the Soviet Union in response to any aggression that we chose to resist.
Well, General Taylor has to leave pretty promptly at 10:30, so I can allow one more question. I don't know which one of you two gentlemen...
Let's have two more.
Good.
I wish to address my question to Dr. Wolfe. You mentioned, sir, that you would... you mentioned that you would hate to see Castro and others with atomic weapons. I'm sure we all agree. Assuming that present allies may become future enemies, would you agree with General Taylor that we should lend NATO, not the member nations, but lend NATO the use of atomic missiles, and if so, under what conditions, with what checks?
I am not in favor of the creation of any new nuclear powers beyond the ones that we already have.
You have been listening to A Blueprint for Defense, recorded highlights of the Harvard Law School Forum. The guest speaker, General Maxwell D. Taylor, a WHDH Radio News and Public Affairs presentation.